Omaha Public Radio presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. Today's speaker will be Nebraska State Senator from the 11th District, Ernie Chambers. He'll give his reflections on his 38-year career in the Nebraska unicameral. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, June 19, 2008, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Gary Kerr, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
Good afternoon. I'm Gary Kerr, chairman of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee. And once a month, the Press Club sponsors a noon forum that we think will be of interest to our members and the public at large. Our noon forums are open to the public. You do not have to be a Press Club member to attend. There is paper and pencil at your tables. The last part of our program will be a question and answer session. So write down your questions and they will be brought to me to ask from the podium. You often hear the speaker that we have today really needs no introduction, and wow, is that ever true today. Our speaker is State Senator Ernie Chambers, who has been a member of the legislature for 38 years. Forced out by term limits, this is his last year. Senator Chambers has had a huge impact on Nebraska law. He has no peer in knowing the ins and outs of the legislative process. When I called Ernie and asked him if he would come to a Press Club noon forum and reflect on his legislative career, I didn't know for sure what he would say. He hasn't said a lot about that since the end of the this year's legislative session. But he agreed to come. We appreciate it. So join me now in welcoming State Senator Ernie Chambers.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you very much. I came here and I left my glasses out in the car. I usually don't use notes, but today I thought I would trick you into thinking I had notes, but all these sheets are empty. Does anybody out there have a pair of reading glasses? I'm going to borrow them. Yes, they work very well. Here's something that I do mention to people. My term ends January the 6th of 2009. Until then, I'm still a state senator, still on the clock, still on the payroll, being paid. We do the work we do in the legislature, some beyond what people think is the call of duty. But regardless of what it is that I do, nobody should ascribe it to nobility. I'm paid for what I do. I'm not paid well, but I am paid. The job carries certain duties and responsibilities, and I knew what they were when I took the job. I didn't know all of them in detail, but I knew that I was being asked to inform myself, use my best judgment, be honest all the time. Now, I may say when it comes to learning things, I will learn as much as I can and do the best that I can. But when it comes to honesty, I do not qualify that by saying honest to the extent that I can be, honest to the extent that is feasible, honest when it doesn't offend anybody. For me, honesty means to do what I think is the right thing for me to do, no matter what. To say what I think ought to be said, no matter to whom. So, I'd like to be noble, but I'm not. People say that what I do takes courage, but for me, it doesn't. Too many times, words are used carelessly. To me, words have meaning. When people speak, their words have more meaning to me than the words have to the speaker. Because I take those words to mean what they're supposed to mean, but the speaker often doesn't mean what he or she says. That guy named Daley, who was the mayor of Chicago, I almost said the king, the mayor of Chicago for all those years, was one of those people who could mangle the language. His syntax was so bunglesome that he, a lot of times, could not tell you exactly what he had said. So when the reporters would write just what he said, and he'd read it in the paper, he would be fuming, and he would order them into his room, and he'd say, "I'm not going to let your paper come in this city hall again. Look what you wrote and said that I said." And the guy said, "Mayor Daley, I taped what you said. I wrote exactly what you said." He said, "Don't write what I said. Write what I mean." Now, I say what I mean, and I mean what I say. And I'm going to give you an example. Words have meaning. People don't pay attention, though. Here's my plan: to write a book that none at all shall read, whether they scan like the wind or plod with glacial speed. I read at a glacial speed. That's why I threw that in. The publisher did muse. Let's give your scheme a shot. Curiosity will snag a multitude like as not. Here's a portion of the hook, said I. It's like a sting and must challenge. Oh, here's the challenge. Ads must challenge. None at all will read the entire thing. I'm reading with borrowed glasses, remember. What, pray, can you write ensuring that the public's bitten? I shall tell them on each page something interesting is written. When a host of books was published, millions flocked and bought them. When they opened them and read, they knew a net had caught them like unwary fish, and indignation turned to rage. Two words, something interesting, appeared on every page. And that's what the ad said. Something interesting will be written on every page. And when they opened that book, each page had only two words, something interesting. Next page, something interesting. And nobody read the entire book. The truth was stated in the ad, but people took what they thought was meant rather than what was said. When you are in the realm of intelligence, and by that I meant where you sneak around and spy on people, you maintain what is called deniability. You want to be in a position to do certain things, you do certain things, but you have to leave a way out so you can deny it. Words should mean what they say when they're presented by those of you who comprise the media. You have an obligation to use language in the appropriate manner, and don't write down to your audience. If a child 10 years old interviewed Einstein, what the child wrote would read like the thoughts of a 10-year-old. The 10-year-old writes Einstein according to the 10-year-old's understanding, not according to Einstein's profound intellect. You have to sometimes challenge the public. Let your syntax be correct. Let your sentences be written in such a way that the subject agrees with the verb or the verb agrees with the subject. When you use the term enamored, don't say enamored with, but enamored of. And to help people remember it, enamored could be substituted for with the word fond. I am fond of this, and you'll never forget. If you say enamored with, it would be like saying fond with. I've seen so many articles written. I've heard so many people who broadcast the news say there was a fire in a house and the fire was contained to the second floor. Not contained to. It might be restricted to the second floor. It may be confined to the second floor, but it is not contained to the second floor. People are careless, but many times they can't go beyond what they know. How do I apply that to what happened in the legislature? I went there thinking that people would be brighter than they turned out to be. By the time I'd been there a while, I began to tell my colleagues, you frustrate me. You talk about education bills, and yet nothing you do, never in the way you speak, do you exemplify what an educated person should be. You do not demonstrate the value of education, and we in government ought to be an example, and you all are not that. Then I say, but you know where I'm being unfair? How can I expect somebody who comes down here with a thimble full of brains to produce a bushel basket full of sense? And some of them wouldn't even get it. Some of you all didn't get it. Of course, you have something to distract you. You're eating your food. And there's an Arabian proverb that says, when the stomach is full, the head is empty. The time that I spent in the legislature was a period of evolution for me. When I got there, I had nothing but contempt for the legislature. I referred to it then, as I did throughout my career, as you all's legislature, because white people put it together. White people run it. It's of, by, and for white people, just as the writing of the media and the media itself. They are of, by, and for white people. Everything that's written is written from the standpoint of white people. It is viewed through white eyes, and it is presented for those with white eyes, white understanding, and white intellects. But how can it be otherwise? Turtles speak turtle. When a turtle speaks, other turtles understand. So when white people are writing about something, they are not identifying with those who are not like themselves. They don't try to put themselves in the shoes or the position of that person and explain it as that person explains it. So by the time they get through analyzing it, massaging it, interpreting it, and then presenting it, people who read feel they're entitled to think that what they're reading is what that person said. Nobody can say better than I can what I want to say. Because sometimes my words are so cogent and sometimes blunt, never do I use profanity. When they do an interview with me on television, they will not allow my voice to be heard. They will show my mouth moving. Then one of those white people will tell the audience what it is that I said, because they don't want what I say to be heard. I pick and choose when I will give an interview on television. I have no control over that. I have no control over an interview that will be written. But those who write, some of them, do a much better job. I see one of them in the audience, and I don't want to embarrass her or destroy Nancy Hicks's reputation by identifying her to you. But if it wasn't for the fact that I have so much respect for her, I would call her by name and let you know who she is. But it would probably cause her to be scorned and shunned by her colleagues. When I came to that legislature, they cut holes in that beautiful wooden ceiling. They have no respect for anything. Oscar Wilde said something like, people, there are individuals who know the cost of everything and the value of nothing. That wood should not have been subjected to that sacrilege. And they cut holes in it so that they could install closed-circuit television cameras to watch me. They brought armed state troopers into the chamber. And when I found it out, I said, what do they think I came down here for? I didn't come down here to fight. That can be done in the street. You think I don't know what a legislature is? People sent me down here to do a job. It's not to reflect ignorance, and it's not to be in fistfights, but I let them know I would defend myself. So they started by profaning that chamber. But I felt a greater profanation occurred when they had pictures of Abraham Lincoln and George Washington on the front wall. So it took me a period of time, but I got those things taken down. George Washington, you see, was a slaveholder. And how in the world could I be a member of this legislature and they have a picture of a slaveholder? It would be like you have an assembly and only one Jewish person is there, and on the wall is a picture of Adolf Hitler on one side and Adolf Eichmann on the other. And people would say, well, Ernie, that's terrible. How can you compare these two men to that? I say, well, you're looking at it through white eyes. George Washington didn't enslave you. George Washington's people didn't rape your ancestors. They didn't own them and breed them like cows, pigs, and chickens. So they're great people to you. Colonel Sanders is a great guy to everybody in this room if you like chicken. But ask the chickens what they thought of Colonel Sanders. And because of that, I wrote a little rhyme where Colonel Sanders, when he got to the pearly gates, was met by a chicken. And the chicken said, Colonel Sanders, I presume. Colonel Sanders turned around and went right back the other way. Now, as time went on, I began to think in terms of my being a member of that legislature, regardless of how I regarded the individuals who were there. I don't like to be a part of anything voluntarily without doing the best that I can or making it the best that I can make it through my effort. So I developed what you might call an institutional attitude toward the legislature. I began to try to drill through my colleagues' thick skulls and find some brain matter, if there was any inside, to let them realize that we are a third part of the government. We are a part of a tripartite government, and our branch is the most powerful because we control the purse strings and we write the laws. Our laws govern the governor, the attorney general, every person in this society, the courts, the police, everybody. And the state agencies have not one penny to spend other than what we grant to them. And you all are going to let them speak like you are a stepchild. You're going to let them insult you, disrespect you, make jokes about you to your face, and you're going to accept it. I said, they're going to see that I'm different from the rest of you. They're not going to treat me like they treat you. And as time went on, that became the case. Lobbyists spoke very reverentially to me, to such an extent that I told them, you don't have to grovel in front of me. That's not what I want. I just want you to show me the respect that you want me to show you. They didn't offer me any meals, didn't offer me any deals, although when I first was there, hadn't been there too long, a person representing the new car dealers came to me, and I was driving a Volkswagen. He said, Senator Chambers, you don't have to drive that Volkswagen. I said, yes, I do. He said, no, you don't. I said, yes, I do. He said, Senator, I don't think you understand what I'm saying. I said, my friend, I don't think you understand what I'm saying. I do have to drive this Volkswagen. He said, I understand. He did not make an inappropriate offer. I did not have to decline anything that was inappropriately offered, but we came to a very good understanding that day. When people understand the milieu in which they operate, there is a language. I tell you, words have meanings. There are sometimes the greatest meaning is found and derived when no words at all are spoken. No words. But there's an understanding because there's a commonality of experience that those people share. And they, from that experience, will know and understand things. I began to defend the legislature. When I'd become aware that a senator had been called out into the rotunda by a lobbyist and spoken to disrespectfully, I would call the senator by name and call the lobbyist by name and tell him he better not talk to me like that. And when you talk to one of my colleagues, that's like talking to me. Then I talked to Cindy. I was there 38 years. She was there 36 years. She's still there now, too. Still on the clock. We're still working. In fact, we'll go down to the office after I leave here. But we began to talk about it, concluded that these are grown people. They are senators just like I am. It's not my duty to defend them as individuals. If they're going to let somebody walk over them, that's the way it's going to be. But it won't happen to me. Now, some people have wondered, how long have I been talking up here? That's not what they wonder. Because I want to leave a half hour for you to ask questions. What time is it now? 25 after I got 5 minutes. So let me mention a few things. Because you probably have things you'd rather ask me about than what I'm saying here. But I'm trying to speak in an overview, general kind of way, so you feel comfortable in asking me anything that you want to. And as I tell reporters, your job is to get information from me. My job is to withhold what I think you shouldn't have, but I'm not offended by any question you ask me. People have asked me, what will I do when I leave here? I'll let that be on your time when you pose a question. But there are five things, one, two, three, four, that I have saved. I saved the Constitution by stopping them from putting trash in it, like protecting trapping, hunting, and fishing. I saved a man on death row, Kerry Dean Moore, who's going to be executed by the Nebraska Supreme Court, and I wrote them a letter telling why they should not do it. No lawyer could intervene on behalf of Moore because he'd given up his appeals and told the court he didn't want any appeals. He wanted nothing filed in his behalf. I wrote the letter, and people told me it was inappropriate. I said, look, this man's going to die. Nobody can do anything. I don't believe in giving up until everything is over. So I wrote the letter, submitted it to the court, and they accepted that letter. They stayed the execution, and the basic arguments that I made in my letter were replicated in the court's opinion. Suppose I'd been like everybody else and said, they said he's going to die, so let him die. No, that's not the way I do. I fought issues that people thought could not be even raised, and I've won on them on behalf of the people. I've helped save that building, believe it or not, by being on a subcommittee that created the attitude and got money to renovate that building. Water used to come into the chamber, rain would leak in, so instead of fixing that, they put big drapes up in the balcony of the chamber to hide the stains on the wall. In the offices, we had furniture mismatched. You had dinette chairs. You had those folding chairs, some of them wood, some of them metal. Desks that came from I don't know where, but it looked like Abraham Lincoln may have carved his initials in some of them in response to what George Washington had carved in it when he had it. If you leaned on the desk one way, the desk leaned that way. If you leaned the other, it leaned the other way. When I first got there, women were still wearing knit suits. If a woman walked past one of those desks in a knit suit, she might snag it on a piece of wood sticking out, and by the time she got to the door, you'd think that she was Mae West doing a strip tease. Her whole suit would have been unraveled. Well, now they've got offices. They've got furniture. My stamp is on a lot of things there, and people will never be aware of it. But I did it because I thought it was the right thing to do. And if somebody wants to know why what I did didn't take courage, they can ask me. One other thing. Then, Gary, I will take questions. When Hurgert got to be a member of the Board of Regents, and some terrible things he had done came to my attention, I told senators, I'll work with you all, and we should impeach him. Well, they started getting shaky-legged because there was opposition to it. But I pushed and pushed. Senator Bourne was the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. A resolution was adopted to study and look at the situation instead of a resolution of impeachment. And I agreed because in the legislature, some things must be done incrementally. Senator Bourne was allowed to select counsel to review the whole matter. They hired a lawyer named Mock. He made a mockery of the whole thing. Instead of producing a well-reasoned legal memorandum, he told the legislature how the legislature shouldn't be dealing with this. It has more important things to do with this time. It's time. This is politically motivated. I looked at that and I was disgusted. So to make a long story short, as a member of the exec board, I made it my business to have a subcommittee of the executive board created to look at the Hurgert affair. Five members were on that subcommittee. I managed to have myself made the chair. They agreed because they trusted my judgment to allow me to hire counsel. I hired David Domina, who had been involved in some activities related to the legislature in the past, so I knew he understood things. To make that long story even shorter, not only did the legislature vote to impeach Hurgert, but the Nebraska Supreme Court convicted him. They kicked his donkey off the board of regents, and he can never run for or hold another public office again. Had I not been there, that wouldn't have happened. I've saved you all, your state, your constitution, for more things than you will ever be aware of. And you will never be aware of them. And I didn't do them so that you'd be aware of them. I did them because it was the right thing for me to do in the job that I had undertaken. My final words, people were trying to get me to make some kind of farewell address, which I don't believe in. I say that Americans and others are obsessed with beginnings and endings. The baby's first word was mama or da-da, they want to record. A person is going to be killed by the state. People want to be there to hear what his last words are going to be. So I had no last words. I could have been melodramatic like Paul. I have fought the good fight. I've finished my course. I've kept the faith. Paul was melodramatic. I could have been dramatic like Jesus, a man of a few words. It is finished. But I'm not melodramatic, and I'm not dramatic. Mine can be summed up in four words. I did my job. Now I'll take any questions that you have.
Remember, there is paper and pencil at your tables. Please write down any questions that you might have, and somebody will come around and get them for them. Just raise your hand. Being the moderator, I get to ask the first question. What is your, as far as legislation passed or unpassed, what do you see as your greatest triumph and your greatest disappointment?
I don't have one thing I could say that's the greatest triumph, but what made me have the most satisfaction is when I got legislation to prohibit the execution of the mentally retarded, prohibited the execution of juveniles, and then stopping the execution of Kerry Dean Moore. When you can point to conduct of yours that led directly to the prevention of somebody being killed, that's very satisfying. But then getting district elections for the city council, the school board, and the county board is meaningful. So I can't really say with certitude what it would be. And there have been so many bills over a 38-year period that I've gotten done. The greatest disappointment, the fact that the legislators to this day have not recognized the power of that legislature, the responsibility that it has, the great amount of good that can be done if it would just be done. Are there individual efforts that I put forth that came up a cropper? Absolutely, but that's a part of life for everybody. So I can't picture one specific item that constitutes a great disappointment for me. I knew not everything I would attempt would be successful, and not everything I did attempt was successful. I could mention something that was very disappointing for me, and that was this. I never had the question answered to me as to when you take a shower, should the curtain be inside the tub or outside the tub?
What do you think is really behind the Nebraska Civil Rights Initiative petition drive and Ward Connolly's passion to do away with affirmative action?
Ward Connolly is a gentleman from California whom black people would refer to as an Uncle Tom. You all might get an idea of our attitude toward him if you think of Judas, Quisling, or Benedict Arnold, a traitor. He is more concerned about contract set-asides. He mentions these other things to try to conceal it. He gets a lot of money from the construction industry. That industry does not want minority group members or women to cut into the racket that they have. But what his aim is to wipe out affirmative action. He ought to just say so. In a state like Nebraska, which if it is as racist as he and his people perceive it to be, he ought to just be forthright and say, we don't think there should be affirmative action. But there's a nagging suspicion in his mind that maybe nobody could be quite as racist as he thinks Nebraskans are, so he has to use smoke and mirrors, cloud the issue, and give them an excuse for voting against affirmative action, which is what they know. So I think his primary aim is to protect the construction industry and others from set-asides, but there are no set-asides in Nebraska. They do not emphasize or even make reference to the fact, as is being done now in some ads, that it applies to women also. If women became aware of that, there would be a different reaction to the whole thing. But once again, it's an issue that pertains to white people. Black people are never going to have complete freedom, justice, and equality in this country. So if you take it away by changing the Constitution, as you've taken away the right of black people to elect and send to represent us whom we please, it just underscores the things that I've always said about Nebraskans. They're racist. They will change their constitution and blatantly tell the world this is what they did, but they're not honest enough to acknowledge it, just as the slaveholders and others who supported it put provisions in the Constitution to recognize slavery, to protect slavery, but they wouldn't use the word itself, while referring to us as persons who owe labor, persons who are imported. They said we had no rights as persons which a white man was bound to respect. So we've dealt with this kind of hypocrisy throughout our lives. For myself, if they put into the Constitution which they want to put into it, it's not going to work, make things that much worse for us. And if all these white businessmen and the Chamber of Commerce and the university are so concerned about diversity, why is not that reflected in what they do right now that they have the power to do? Words, and only words, as old Jesus said, they acknowledge me with their mouth, but their hearts are far from me.
We've got several questions here regarding your future. One person wants to know about your political future. What will you do?
Learning Community.
Learning Council. Community Board. Are you going to run for that? You're going to run for City Council, County Board. What are you going to do?
There are four things I can tell you right now I'm not going to do. Three things. To be sure, I'll never pick cotton. I'll never run for the City Council. I'll never run for the County Board. And I'll throw in the fourth one, I'll never wear short britches. As far as what I will do ultimately, I answer that now, as I've done ever since people started asking me, by quoting Stonewall Jackson. He was a general. He was asked how he was going to conduct a certain military campaign, what he would do. He said, if the sleeves of my coat knew my plans, I should have to burn my coat. So I'm not telling anybody what it is that I will do. I've tried to maintain relatively good health, and I think I've done it. So that when the legislative career ends, then there's a life after that. But because I filed that suit against God, and God may be like what you all say, he's just sitting up there waiting. So January the 6th comes, I'm out of the legislature, and I say, free at last. And God say, not so, kill him. And I'll die January the 7th. And there'll be greater joy in Nebraska than when they got term limits. So even in death, I will have made my enemies happier than anybody had made them in their whole life. I will have beat them. O death, where is thy sting? O grave, where is thy victory? The Learning Community Council Board is something that many people have been pressuring me, literally pressuring me, to run for. Some of my colleagues would do it on the floor of the legislature. It would be the first board sitting to regulate the learning community. Nobody wants to see status quo or things go on as they have been. For some reason, they get the impression that if I am there, it's going to be done the way it ought to be. And maybe it will be, and maybe it won't be. But it's a tragedy when in any society, so much confidence, so much hope is reposed in one person. If that person lives up to everything that those who think well of that person, or who think ill of that person, but believe he or she will do the right thing. When that person dies, everything's over. All of the eggs should never be put in the basket of one person. You need to realize that others have responsibility, others have ability, and they should not hide behind the notion that one person is going to do it. At this point, I genuinely have not made up my mind what I will do as far as running for that position. I'm inclined toward it, and I'm telling you that much because on that issue, which is so important, I don't want to seem to be coy. But get this, if you've been in as many battles as I had been for 38 years in the cauldron of the legislature, in the belly of the beast. Then somebody's going to ask you, will you sit on a school board? Sitting around with people who are going to talk and talk and talk. Half the time don't even know what they're talking about. Scared of their own shadow. And I'm supposed to be around people like that and waste the rest of my life or 4 years or whatever the period is for which I would serve? That, I think, is unfair. But again, nobody could make me do it. If I decide to fall into that position, which may be a foolish thing to do, the responsibility is mine. The blame is on me. As many reversals as I've had in the legislature, nobody held a gun to my head and made me go there. Nobody. I chose to be there every moment of every hour of every day of every week of every month of every year of every decade that I was there. But here's what did happen, in fairness to me. When you hold yourself out as somebody who will help people, a kind of moral obligation can begin slowly to develop, and there is not a complete freedom to choose to say yay or nay. There is a type of moral suasion or coerciveness that you feel, at least that I feel. And I no longer, after a certain point, felt completely free to get out of that legislature, although there were many occasions when I wanted to. The district needed somebody like me, somebody who would stand up to those people, who would not back up, who would not be bought off, who would not be frightened off, who would do everything every minute that needed to be done to uphold the race. What race? The human race. Which members of the human race? Those who had no voice, those who were marginalized, those who were held in contempt, those who were shunned, those who were made to feel like they're the unpeople, and they came in all sizes, shapes, colors, and every religion. And as pathetic as it might seem to people, but they're lucky that I don't have a heart and that I'm not a Christian and that I'm not religious, because I never would put them down. They came to me for help. And I'd say, do you go to church? Yes. Well, have you gone to your minister, a priest, or rabbi? Yeah, but they couldn't do anything. So then I would help them. They'd say, Ernie, thank you, and I'm going to pray for you. And I never said, why do you think your prayers will help me when they didn't help you? Why couldn't you pray to the one you're going to pray for in my behalf? Why couldn't you pray for that one to give you the help that you came to, the one called the devil, seeking help from, and you got the help from the one you call the devil when you couldn't get it from anybody else? So people are lucky that I'm not religious, that I'm not small-minded, that I'm not a Democrat, that I'm not a Republican, that I'm Ernie. And as Popeye said, I am what I am, and that's all that I am. What I wish could have happened is that people just jump up and holler out their questions, but we'll let them be filtered, because when I come as a guest in somebody's house, I follow the house rules.
Could you give us more insight into your efforts to split the Omaha school district into three segregated sub-districts? In my words, did you abandon that effort?
First of all, the question's incorrect. They wouldn't have been segregated sub-districts. Somebody in the media, based on something that Pat Bourne, at the behest of OPS, said, those districts were going to be drawn not by the legislature, not by me. They would have been based on the location of the high schools. And there was nothing in that law that mandated that those districts be predominantly African American on one side, predominantly white on the western end, predominantly Latino in South Omaha. That's the way they phrased it. My approach, and that of those who supported it, was to provide local control in those districts, however they were drawn, for the people who lived in those districts, whose children attended those schools. I made it clear many times that in the district of which I was a part, there would be no attempt to have only black teachers. We would want whoever was the most qualified. And by that, we meant somebody who understood the subject matter, who now knew how to impart that information to the children, who respected the children, their parents, and the function of a school, which is to provide education. And we wanted the children to get a quality education. And as a benchmark, we would say they would achieve at the level appropriate to the grade where they find themselves. And then we'll build on that. But we wanted a rigorous, meaningful curriculum. And we wanted teachers who respected us and our children, as everybody wants. And I pointed out that white people have always had local control. They've always dictated what would be in their schools, who would teach their schools. But they went beyond that, and they wanted to dictate to us also. They had carved out of a black womb. See, the majority of children in OPS schools are non-white. So that OPS is like a black womb. Carved out of that womb is a white fetus, West Side. Carved out by white people, for white people. It remained white even while they said Ernie's resegregating the schools. So if you're worried about segregation, why don't you do something about white West Side? Because when white people do it, it's all right. When black people talk about having some kind of local control, it's not all right. So, was I resegregating the schools? They're segregated already. They are segregated right now and are more segregated now than they ever were before. So, white people accepted that notion. Schools are segregated. No, that's what they say. Ernie's resegregating the schools. They are segregated. So to try to make white people understand, I said, to say that I'm resegregating schools that are already segregated is like saying I can make water wetter. That was a sham. These white people don't care anything about integration. And when they talk about integration, I say, do you have black neighbors? No. You go to a black church? No. Are your coworkers mostly black? No. Are you married to a black person? No. Well, certainly you want your child to marry a black person. Oh, for heaven's sake, no. I said, well, everything that you say bespeaks a notion of segregation, yet here you are hollering about integration. You know why they do that? They know it's never going to happen. But if they can create that false trail and have black people engaging in a futile argument about integration when nobody wants it, nobody cares about it, it keeps our attention from focusing on the fact that our children are cheated and poor white children are cheated also. When you can show in certain specific discrete areas of the city that the children are from 2 to 2.5 grade levels behind, and that over 50% of the children are non-white, but 92% of the teachers are white, something is wrong. So I am never going to be deterred from what I say and do to try to help black children, Latino children, and poor children get a fair shake. I'm not going to be deterred by somebody saying, Ernie, you're interested in segregation. I say, call it what you want to. I don't care about segregation. I don't care about integration. I care about education. And no child of mine has to sit next to a white child to learn. My child needs to be in a classroom where there are up-to-date textbooks or where there are textbooks for several months at North High. The classrooms didn't even have textbooks. And I had to fight and fight and fight. This was about 2 years ago, not way back in the dark ages. You all don't know that. You don't care about it. So why would I make a fool out of myself coming to people who don't have a strong sense of morality and try to use moral suasion to persuade them to do the right thing when morality is not what moves them? I have to use whatever strength, whatever force I can bring to bear. And now to be blunt, because you all need to have this. You know how I got things done in that legislature? I intimidated them. I put fear into them. They were afraid of me. They didn't respect me. And to make them know that I knew what it was about, I told them the little joke I tell about Bismarck and his little nephew. Little nephew sitting on Uncle Bismarck's knee. Uncle Bismarck said, nephew, what do you want to be when you grow up? Uncle Bismarck, I want to be just like you. Nephew, why do you want to be like Uncle Bismarck? Because everybody's afraid of you. And you want to be like Uncle Bismarck because people are afraid of me? Why is that, son? Don't you want people to love you? He said, Uncle Bismarck, when people love you, they take advantage of you. When they're afraid of you, you take advantage of them. That child knew white people's respect means nothing when they say they're giving it to a black person. You know, the black person they respect, as they use the word, somebody who's quiet, who's meek, who's apologetic, who's humble, who needs their permission, who needs their affirmation. But they don't respect a black man who's going to stand up on his feet and look them in the eye and not blink, who will not back up a centimeter, who will not be intimidated by them, who will not allow his people to be abased, debased, and messed over. That is one they don't respect. They fear him. And without that fear, I wouldn't have gotten anything done in the legislature. And how did I put them in fear since I wasn't going to be strangling them or hitting them in the mouth? I mastered their rules and I beat them at their own game. And my mantra became a loaded brain beats a loaded gun. Unless, of course, you're in a gunfight, which we weren't in there. So I let them know, you got something that means something to you. Your bills mean more to you than me. You identify as a white person with what you're doing. If I get rid of what you're doing, I get rid of you. You want this bill? I'll kill it. You can't kill it? Okay, we'll see, and I'll do it by your rules. They thought I was weak and tired and frail like them just because I'm 70 years old. I told them, let's start at 8 in the morning and go to midnight without stopping. No restroom breaks, no coffee breaks, no food from the lobbyists. This is not going to be the hungry club. You're not going to be Captain Lunch Hunter. But they needed to rest. And I told them, I'll go till midnight. I never sat in my chair during the last 2 years I was there. I never sat in my chair. And there was a reason for it, to show them, you all get tired. I never get tired. The longer the day goes and the more weary you become, the stronger I become. And I will whip you. You will never whip me down. And they say, how are you going to do it? So while I'm talking, I'm writing amendments. And to write an amendment, for y'all who don't know it, if you want to change the language that's already written, you have to say, on page such and such, line such and such, strike such and such, and insert, therefore, such and such. And you have to do all that while you're talking to them, which I did. I would recite poetry to them, make up poems on the spot, quote the Bible. And one senator came then, he was very offended because he said, I wish you'd say Bible instead of Bible. I said, well, whatever you call it doesn't matter. I said, you say tomato, I say tomato. You say potato, I say potato. Doesn't matter whether you say potato, potato, tomato, tomato, or Bible or Bible. And this just went off, so I'll let that be my answer. That's it.
During your 38 years, which of our governors has impressed in a positive way the most?
You know what? I wish I'd gotten that question, so I'm going to repeat it. During my 30 years, which governor has done what? Impressed the most?
Impressed the most in a positive way.
In a positive way. As somebody said, when Eisenhower was asked to say something good about Nixon, if you give me enough time to think about it, I'll come up with something. Jim Exon was somebody who was very blunt and forthright, but he was narrow-minded, and he vetoed some of my district election bills. One of the ironies is I finally got a district election bill for the city council after he was out of office and couldn't veto it anymore because Republican, who was that guy who was, anyway, Republican governor signed it. Then Jim Exon, whose son could never get elected to the city council in an at-large election, got elected to the Omaha School Board by virtue of districts. So Exon was one who was blunt and crude but direct. Not any of them was completely honest or showed too much of what I would call intelligence. But remember, they weren't trying to be a governor of and for black people, but of and for white people. And I divined how shallow white people's understanding is, how low their standards are by the kind of people they put in governor, the governor's chair, and by how little respect the governor showed for them. I listened to things that Johans would say. I watched things that Heineman will do. And I say, he must be think he's dealing with a bunch of fools. Then I remember, oh, that's right, he's not dealing with people like me. He's dealing with his own people, and he knows his own people. And that's how I judge you all, by those you put in office. Judge black people by me. They put me in office. I've had white people write to me and say they wish somebody like me would represent them. So in fairness to these people who've been governed, they are doing the job as politicians that they think the white people require of them, since the white people are the ones who put them there. So I'm sure there are different elements in the white population who could find a lot of very positive things that the governors have done. For example, giving big tax breaks to the powerful corporations. And the other legislators would not listen to me when I said, you have a population in this state of 1,700,000 people, and when you say that this segment over here, which is getting a lot of benefits from the state and would pay substantial taxes, are not going to have to pay taxes, the expenses of government go on, so others will have to pay more. So when you make these big shots pay less, you make the little shots pay more. Didn't register. I said, well, then look at it this way. When you're going to give these big businesses breaks and you write the statute so only the biggest corporations can qualify, you're making these little business persons who you say are the backbone of the economy pay taxes in order to subsidize these big business people who are their competitors and who are going to run them out of business. You make this little person at position A subsidize Walmart over here so that Walmart can run them out of business. It didn't take. So it just made me think that what these white people send down to the legislature is some pretty poor stuff. But it's what white people want, and it led me to develop another mantra. If they want to send a mule skinner down here to represent them, because a mule skinner understands them in a democracy, or representative democracy, they have a right to send a mule skinner. That was my attitude. White people didn't take that attitude toward me. They said when they were seeking term limits, the only way we'll get Chambers out of the legislature is to stop him through the Constitution. We don't want black people to be able to send somebody like him down here anymore. So when they considered one black man of greater worth than 48 white people, they again tell me something, and it's hard for me to be humble. And I've said on the floor of the legislature, if Alibaba can handle 40 thieves, I should be able to handle 48 of you. And when I'm explaining to people that Nebraska has a 49-member legislature and I'm the only black one there, they say, boy, that's not a fair fight, is it? I say, it certainly is not. They need more help. And you know, white people don't like that. You know why they don't like it? Because it's true. If I was a lick, spittle, swallower, if I would let them kick me in my rear and they'd love me. But I'm not going to take low for white people, and that's why they can't stand me. I'm uppity. I get out of my place. But they envy me, and they envy black people because they know what I know. They know how to do what I do. They wrote the rules, but they don't have what it takes to carry them out. It's not a matter of knowledge. It's not a matter even of intelligence. It's a matter of determination and will, and my will not be broken. And that's what they can't stand, and that's what they can't forgive me for. And they wanted me at the end to become teary-eyed like children leaving high school or grade school. The time has come for closing books and long last looks to end. Not for me. You know what I said? Although I wouldn't let them hear me say it, but I'll let you all hear me. But I'm not going to do it dramatically. Free at last, free at last. Thank whatever gods there be. I'm free at last. I fought against term limits as long as I could. When it became clear to me that term limits would not be overturned, I accept reality. And my mind went in a different direction. But you all, you white people, are the ones who are going to suffer. The governor even told me, and I'm saying it publicly, Ernie, when you're gone, I'm going to have to veto more bills. Not even because I'm opposed to the subject matter, but they're going to be so poorly written. They will be vague. They will be contradictory. The attorney general has said to me and others, he's going to have to increase his staff to defend these unconstitutional bills. They don't read those bills. They bring them to me. They expected me to rewrite bad bills that I didn't even like. And you know what would make me do it? The bill was going to pass. It's been my view that when the legislature puts something in the law books, people should be able to go to that law book, read it, and it makes sense and they understand. So I would take out contradictory language. What I could have done was let these white people be bitten by the beast that they let loose. Let them pass these bad bills and let them be struck down by the court. But I had a sense of responsibility as a member of the legislature. So I read bad bills, rewrote them, killed many of them, and caused lobbyists and others to say, we won't even offer these bad bills. You all may not notice it right away, but there are others who are going to be aware of what it was I did when I was in that legislature that nobody is going to do again. But remember, it's your state, it's your constitution, it's your legislature. And when they can get people to put in the constitution, protect hunting, trapping, and fishing. Look, I tried to, in a sense, reach back from the grave of a no longer there politician by offering a bill to make it illegal to hunt, trap, and fish, and it was killed in committee. I said, here's why I did it, to show you that in a state like Nebraska, nobody could get a piece of legislation through that would hurt trapping, hunting, and fishing. So why are you going to contaminate the Constitution with crazy stuff like that? So then I began to write amendments of things that ought to also be protected by the Constitution. One of the well, I won't go through that, but that's my answer. If I'm as intelligent as people have said, if I'm as capable in writing legislation and rewriting bad legislation and stopping bad legislation as they say I am, how much more good could I have done for the state if I didn't have to give so much of my time dealing with these simple-minded things, stopping bad legislation they should have been ashamed to present? But lawyers wouldn't speak out, judges wouldn't, editorial writers would not, because Ernie is doing it, and they'd let me do it. So I told them, I'm the garbage man. It shouldn't be that way, but if that's the way it is, then as long as I'm here, I'll pick up the garbage. But it's you all's garbage, and it is. Brothers and sisters, friends, enemies, neutrals, I've been around white people all my life. I've never had a black teacher in my life. The elementary school I went to was Lothrop. It was a white school. When I went to Tech High, it was a white school. When I went to Creighton, it was a white school. When I went to Creighton Law School, it was a white school. Do you know the only thing Creighton hates more than the fact that I graduated from their college and their law school? The fact that I tell people that I did. And I don't want to overstay the time, so.
Ernie Chambers, thank you for being our Noon Forum guest today. Just one other thing. Our thanks also to our audience here at Joslyn Castle, which is our temporary home while the press club is being renovated. And thanks to KIOS Public Radio for broadcasting today's program. We are adjourned.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. Our guest speaker has been Ernie Chambers, Nebraska State Senator from the 11th District. He has given his reflections on his 38-year career in the Nebraska unicameral. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, June 19, 2008, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club presents these noontime educational forums each month. After 2 months off, they will resume in September. If you'd like to attend future programs in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.